plan on flying? In order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID. Learn how to get your real ID today at tsa.gov/real ID or visit your local DMV.
Edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone who influenced me in a major way. You may know him as the designer of the logo for Burn. You may know him as one of the minds behind the fanzine Boiling Point. You may know him as the guy who did Irate Records. You may know him as the guy from No Escape. You may know him from the band Kiss Goodbye, but probably you know him from the legendary band Dead Guy, who are back together with a new record. More on that in 1 second. Tim Singer is on the podcast, and as I said, this is a huge vocal influence on me and someone I've wanted to talk to for God, since I was like a little kid. So this is a big one for me. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you would like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on just Instagram, at Left for Damian. There is a Turned Out a Punk podcast TikTok account, a YouTube page, an Instagram page, and a Facebook page. All those can be found at Turned Out a Punk on those platforms. And there are videos that are put out for this podcast. I put up videos for this podcast, and Tristan puts up the videos I make for this podcast on those platforms. So you can check those videos out, and you can also keep abreast about what's going on the show by following that stuff. That's really all it does for you. But, you know, it's worth it. Maybe it's worth it. If you don't want to do that, just tell all your friends about this podcast. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast. And we do it twice a week. We're back to twice a week because we have a new streaming show as well, hosted by the great Nick Woge from Cold World, from a legend of design, a legend of music, and legendary now for his hot takes on I Heard They Suck Live, the Turned Out a Punk kind of wrap-up after show, which happens every Wednesday live at 9 p.m. You can check it out where you listen to, check it on YouTube, and then it will go up on Friday on the platforms where you're listening to this podcast. So we have two shows a week now. We have Turned Out a Punk, and then we have I Heard They Stream Live every 2 weeks, and every week that that's not happening, there's going to be a Turned Out a Punk Classics. We're back to the two episodes a week schedule. Let everyone know. Put up signs, billboards in your community. Let people know that there's now two episodes of Turned Out a Punk a week again. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. And we don't have any shows coming up right now, I don't think. I don't think we have any no shows. Maybe we do. Check there. They will know better than me. And we also have a bunch of records, and you can find links to all that stuff over at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, this is a guy who is a huge one for me. Tim Singer is on the podcast today. And I was one of those people that loved Dead Guy. Like, first time I heard Fixation on a coworker, it melted my brain. And then Dead Guy 2.0. I liked it. It wasn't as much my thing. But then when Kiss It Goodbye came out, like, Dead Guy was kind of just before my time. Whereas Kiss It Goodbye, I remember being so excited before that record came out. I remember getting those records, like the 7-inches and then the LP, and just, oh my gosh, this guy's voice is perfect. And now Dead Guy is back together, and they have a brand new record coming out on June 17th. Vinyl is going to be shipping on June 25th on Relapse Records. You can go over to the fine folks at relapse.com and pre-order the record now. This thing is a monster. They've released three songs so far. All three are great. There's no other way to put it. You can check those things out. There's also a video, I believe, for Kill Fee, which is also out now. You'll find links to all this in the bio. And Tim's got one of those voices. We talk about this in the episode, so I don't want to be redundant by hashing it all out right now. But there's just this certain type of hardcore voice, which, I don't know. I can't really put my finger on it. I haven't put enough thought into what makes it perfect like it is. But John Brannon, Tim Singer, DeWitt, there's just certain people that have these voices that, man, these are my vocal gods, not Robert Plant. Who the fuck is Robert Plant when you got Tim Singer? Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on. I'll save the hot takes for when we do. I heard they stream live. In the meantime, head over, grab that brand new, or pre-order that brand new Dead Guy record, Near Death Travel Service. And I don't think I said that. But anyway, the album is called Near Death Travel Service. This intro is being recorded very late at night or very early in the morning, depending on your definition. So I won't ramble on anymore because I don't know how much sense I'm making. In the meantime, though, sit back, relax, and enjoy the great Tim Singer on Turned Out a Punk. Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sure thing, man.
Well, as I
sort of honored to be here.
Well, that is huge for me because it is a huge honor to have you here. I reserve this for the on-air portion of the discussion. You're a huge influence on me as a vocalist. Like, I feel like you are, I feel like anyone who knows that you're one of the greats to kind of do the aggressive vocal style. So as someone who kind of follows in that tradition, it is a privilege to get to talk to someone who played a huge role in my development in that world.
I appreciate that. I mean, I have my own Mount Rushmore, and I do appreciate hearing that from people because I do sort of give it my all, you know?
It's like an under-respected art, I think. Like, especially getting older, doing this kind of vocal. Like, you look at, not everyone can kind of hold on to their voice. I think John Brannon, who's someone I've heard you bring up from time to time. To me, he's like the Frank Sinatra of this vocal style, where he gets better with it as he gets older.
Yeah, and I feel like Laughing Hyenas is underappreciated. Like, I'm like, that's the shit he did with that. I'm obviously Negative Approach, right? That's just a no-brainer. But I never saw Negative Approach 1.0, but I saw Laughing Hyenas a ton and couldn't believe, first of all, he would stumble on the stage, right? Like, he was just a hot mess at the time. I hope I'm not speaking out of school with that. I think it's well documented. But I say that to say, never once did they not fucking destroy live when I saw them. They were like, it was amazing. I couldn't believe from the second he grabbed the mic and the song started. The power. Him and Rollins live, I don't think I've seen better. And that's what I aspire to, like pretty much those two.
It's almost like the ego and the id of aggressive vocals, him and Rollins.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like Rollins is much more self-conscious, more like lots of homework, like really works the crap, you know, like almost overachieving. And John Brannon, I think, is that guy that you can push up on stage at 4 a.m. when he's been drinking all day and just, he can just deliver, right? It's like, it is like the two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and I think it's like one's like very unconscious, and one's, like you're saying, like very introspective and self-aware. Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks to the fact that one guy's kind of, you know, I'm not doing this to talk shit on Henry Rollins. Obviously, he's accomplished a ton of shit in life. But one guy's still doing it and one guy's stepped away. I think it kind of speaks to the different approaches to this very ego, you know?
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, like, I think you and I are like, we're older, right? So I think you probably ask yourself those questions about yourself. Like, what's driving me to keep doing this? Like, I don't need to do this necessarily, right? Like, so is it my ego? Is it what, you know, is it a sense of just, I can't help it and I was born to do this? Like, what is it, right? Like, And maybe Rollins, I feel like sort of calculated, like, I'm done with that. right? And you put it on the shelf.
Yeah. And like that kind of like painfully self-aware. It's funny because like Ray Kappa was just on the podcast and Porcel had been on and talked about a period where Youth of Today broke up because Ray wanted to start sounding like Blast. And and said that he wanted to get his Rollins on. And I think all of us lead singers have that in us where we kind of want to start, taking our shirt off and grooving on stage, like kind of like, getting to the sort of like Jim Morrison side of things. And then the John Brandon thing, like you're saying, it's like, I've seen him, he's in great shape these days, but I've still seen him party all night and still be able to get up the next day on stage and out scream all of us.
Yeah. That's incredible. Well, I remember. I mean, I used to hang out with Youth of Today. I wasn't like in their inner circle. I was probably in the next circle, right? Because I was in New York in 87, 88, 89, 90 kind of time. Sending backups on their, that We're Not In This Alone, that kind of thing. And I do remember, and like I was tighter with Walter out of all those guys. But I remember Walter saying like, yeah, Ray wanted to do this sort of Blast thing with that song, Keep It Up. That's where they were trying to be like Blast. And I was like, that's cool. I fucking love Blast. Used to say doing Blast. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But they sort of, I think, decided that was not the way to go.
No, I could see why everyone else in the band, but the lead singer would push back on that. Like, right. No, we're not doing the Rollins band thing with this band. It's a band. And I know it's funny because when I brought it up to Ray, he pushed back on it. Like, I don't remember that. I wasn't trying to get my Rollins on. I don't know what you mean by that.
I think a ton of us were, like you said, like, I remember like Dan O'Mahony at one point, like made some joke about like more Rollins than you, like, everybody was just, it was definitely in the air. Right. I feel that. Yeah. I mean, me as a singer, I feel like he was taking it to a place, like he didn't rest on his laurels with Black Flag. Right. And like, he took it to another level. And first time I saw Rollins band was a small club in South Jersey, and there might have been 20 of us, and it was like the small little dive bar in Margate. And I'm like, this is a guy who's been in Black Flag forever and played huge shows, and now he's playing to like 20 people and delivered like you wouldn't believe. And I was like 17, 18 at the time, and I was like, holy fuck. And that stayed with me to this day, where it's like that mindset of like, no matter what, you go to 11. Right. For whoever's in the room. And that translates to recording and practice. Like, I was reading, this is cheesy as it sounds. It's like, I'm reading Get in the Van. You're just sort of, and it's like, this is pre-internet too. Right. So you're just getting your inspo from wherever you can. He was the guy sharing the most, like he's letting you peek behind the curtain the most, right? Like basically his tour diaries and whatever. Right. And he's iconic. And back then tattoos were scary and like not the whole thing. So there was definitely like this allure. And John Brandon was nowhere to be found at that time, other than after Hyenas came around. But he wasn't trying to build this persona the way Henry was. Like, Henry was very consciously building a persona, and it kind of worked.
Well, because like when you think about it, we're up there on stage, and I mean this as us pure lead singers, not hiding behind one of those guitars or anything.
Right.
Like what we're doing up there is like we got two instruments, our voice, and then we've also got our ego. And that ego is a defensive thing. Like you're saying, when you're playing to 20 people a night, you got to go out there and still play like it's like 200 people losing their minds at a packed basement or something.
I know, it's funny because sometimes I think like, man, like the drummer's got it easy, man. It's like, if it's a shitty show and there's no one there, it looks the same to them. It's just a dark void back there. They're just playing their shit, right?
Yeah, my ass hasn't changed at all in the last 20 years.
So, yeah. Anyway, thanks for the compliment.
Well, I got to start it off the way they all start off, though, which is, Tim, how'd you get into punk? Remember the first time you ever came across it?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like there was like, it was December 11th, but, older brother, 4 years older, which is like an eternity, and whatever he thought was cool, I thought was cool. So it went from Zeppelin and Kansas to Black Sabbath and Aerosmith, and then eventually Sex Pistols and The Clash and shit like that. And then, but what I remember specifically blowing my mind was finding a Dead Kennedys Too Drunk to Fuck 7-inch in his room, you know, and I would just go hang out in his room, whether he's there or not, and just play his records, right? And I was like, you can't help but want to put that on, first of all. Like, I was like, can you do that? Hey, can you be called the Dead Kennedys? You know, like, even that was even shocking at the time. And then B, I'm like, too drunk to fuck. I got to hear this. And it's like basically surf punk, you know what I mean? Like, you know, with Jello's weird high-end vocals. And then that just made me want to try more shit, right? Like, Suicidal Tendencies got their hooks into me real early with Institutionalized, like that kind of stuff. I almost feel like they don't get enough credit. Like, there's always like the staples, you know, Black Flag, Bad Brains, Minor Threat, of course, all that stuff. But Suicidal was huge to me back then. So was that. It was basically, and then, you know, I remember my brother sending me to the local record store to buy Walk Among Us, right? Shit like that. And then I was lucky enough to, and then there's a whole look to it. You know, I did, it was the classic thing. It's the 80s. I don't fit in. I sort of don't feel like I fit in. I don't want to be a jock. I'm not a cool kid, but I'm also like not a nerd or a loser. Like, I just was not interested in anything that popular culture had to offer. Right. And so New York was right there. My brother would come home with stories of going to clubs or whatever. So it was like, I could hop on a train and go to New York, and then you discover the killer record stores. And then you're just sort of off to the races, right? You're going, I was spoiled. It was the 80s. The Ritz would have these rock hotel shows with like Black Flag, Dead Kennedys, Social Distortion, Circle Jerks, DOA, Cro-Mags, all these, like, to me, these felt like national acts, Husker Du, whatever. And that was like amazing, right? That was like a train ride from where I grew up, right? And it was still a secret from all of my peers in high school. And it was a big fuck you to them when I'd wear the shirts or whatever. And then I discovered CBGBs. Like April of 87, I think it was, Agnostic Front. And not only was it the music I love, the band is like right there sweating on you. And in the pit is like, there's Harley from the Cro-Mags just like going ape shit, right? And you're like, what the, you know, and then there's no turning back. Like, I, you know, so lucky to grow up around that at that time. You know what I mean? It's like, you look back now and it's like, it's sort of unbelievable, right? Like,
yeah, if you start breaking down all the stuff that was happening in New York during that time period in different places, be it art or rap music or punk,
yeah.
It's just like that, what an incredible time of culture in like a really geographically tiny, tiny little place.
Yeah. No, I remember Gus Pena, who everybody calls Gus Straight Edge, and he's on the cover of The Way It Is, and he's like sort of the fixture Gorilla Biscuits roadie. This is back when we would swap tapes. He made me a tape. And it like had Side by Side before it was out, and maybe Straight Ahead and shit like that on one side, and the other side was hip hop. It was like LL Cool J and Public Enemy, you know, because all that shit was happening at the same time too. Like, it's like, holy, you know, KRS-One, like all this shit was happening. It's crazy.
Was your brother playing in bands at all?
He's dabbled, right? And he's still super into it. And he plays guitar, he writes, but he's just never done anything that's like been on a label really or anything like that. And he's taking pictures, and he's just, you know, a lifelong fan, and he'll never stop making the music either, I think, but he's never like gotten in the van and toured or anything like that, but he's seen some incredible shows.
Well, that was kind of your first thing too, was also taking pictures, right? Because you take pictures of the Wide Awake 7-inch, and
as you said, Wide Awake was in my zine. So me, my stepbrother, my best friend, who I grew up with, we were like, you know, three of the 10 hardcore kids, punk kids in our, you know, in our part of New Jersey. And it was actually our first years of college where we were all sort of split up, and Dennis, who my stepbrother was in Boston, and was like, I want to start a zine and call it Boiling Point, because, you know, he's in the land of SSD, right? And he was straight edge. But we were like, I was like, I don't want to do exclusively straight edge thing. Like, the youth group thing is so everywhere. I was like, I want to document everything. Like, because I, you know, I was in the, what got me into punk was like, you know, Black Flag, Reagan Youth, Dead Kennedys. It wasn't all just Youth of Today and Youth of Today Junior stuff, but. So we started interviewing bands, going to shows, taking pictures at the Anthrax, at CB's, etc. Someday there'll be a book that I put out if I find the time. But yeah, so that's probably the first way I contributed was doing a zine, you know. That's how I met people like the Girl Biscuits guys and the Youth Today guys. Yeah.
Because I've got, years and years ago, I got a collection of bootleg photocopied Bowling Point fanzines.
Right.
I've poured over many years and since acquired a couple of originals. They've gotten really expensive. Like I looked at an issue of number 5 at Joint Custody and it's like $250 and with 3 kids, Jesus. $250 for a fanzine.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It's so funny with that stuff because I'm like I designed these shirts back then too. Like I was doing girls and these things sell for so much money. And like at the time, I would like let people just have my silk screens. Like you weren't doing anything precious. You were just part of a scene. And, you know, I was making shirts for bands, not really making any money on it, just doing it because it's a cool band. I knew how to do it, right? Like the stuff all becomes precious later, right? All this, you know. I mean, the record collecting thing, that was already a thing. You know, like I remember everybody in New York was like looking for pay to come, right? And you could still go to like old record stores, obscure ones that like in the West Village or something, and you'd hear if someone got lucky going through a bin. And you know, when I met Gavin Vaden Black from Burn and Absolution at the time, he's the one who said, if you ever see anything with the Exclaim logo on the back, just buy it, you know, before I knew what the hell what that even meant, you know. So the record thing was there, but yeah, it's funny how precious all this stuff is now.
And it's interesting how it's just because people have imbued it with this. Like there's no, obviously I think this shit's awesome. But it's not imbued with any sort of value. Like there's no intrinsic value. Like, I should say there's no intrinsic value to this stuff. Like we've imbued it with this value. Like people have like been like, this is really important. Like this cultural artifact, issue number 5 of Boiling Point, the controversial 5th issue is a very important document. I know you're out with it by that point, but
yeah.
It is a zine that has been, I think, discussed in many group chats since the invention of the cell phone.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, like in like the folklore, right? Like that comes with stuff. I mean, I think Dead Guy's probably been the biggest recipient of the folklore thing, right? Like he disappeared for 20, 25 years and he became a clothing company or like, and there's like some massive feud and all this stuff. Like, it's just, yeah, it's funny.
Well, it was that the name was sold to a Japanese clothing company, right? Like that was that was from Victory Magazine.
And I think Dave wrote that. I think Dead Guy 2.0, which is after me, I think they broke up and I think Dave might have written that as a joke or something and put it somewhere. And then of course it catches fire.
Yeah. We're jumping way ahead because believe me, I got minutia questions about No Escape and
cool.
Dead stuff first. Also you did take photos for Blood, Sweat, No Tears, right?
The Sick of It All record?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, that's a great record. And I think the photos in it is what really sells it to me as like a first, you know, viewer of it as a kid.
Yeah. And like, yeah, I mean, like I said, I was spoiled, right? Like you could go to CB's. It's like every week there was like a show it's like legendary at this point, right? If it's not Sick of It All, it's Raw Deal. It's not Raw Deal, it's Youth of Today or Gorilla Biscuits or Judge or whatever. Even later on Born Against and stuff like that. And then like smaller bands would come through like Swizz or out of town bands wouldn't get the love. But New York got so much of it. You know, you got a demo for a day. But Sick of It All were one of the first. I mean, everything back then started with demos too. So I had the Sick of It All demo and it was fucking incredible. And then live, they were incredible. And then, you know, then like, it's funny because like people think of them or they did back then as like sort of a tough guy band, but they were just good guys. You know what I mean? Like they would, if you're down with them, like they could have known me for 5 minutes and known I was cool. And if they saw me getting beat up, they would have jumped in. Right. Like there was just like, there was that quality to them. And yeah. And back then I remember that LP coming out and we were just always eager to give our pictures to these bands we loved. Like we just were like, take whatever you need and just give credit to Boiling Point. Right. Yeah, and that record's incredible.
given that you like ran Irate Records, you know, and you put out a compilation, Born Against is on it, and then you're also doing photos for Sick of It All. Like at that Sick of It All, Born Against beef, was there like a need to take sides for people, or was it just like this is something too amazing to get involved in?
That was something to witness, right?
Yeah.
You know, I have respect for both sides. Like Sam from Born Against, he sent Boeing Point hate mail that was printed in like issue 2 or something, where he made fun of us for all being like wearing Champion sweatshirts and yada, yada, yada. And we wrote a happy rebuttal. And like, I've since like become like, to me, I like that shit, right? I like exchange of ideas and we don't all have to be the same. I mean, so yeah, when that happened, I think both sides are probably a little silly. We're all young, stupid 20 somethings at that point. Like, you know, thinking we know more than we do and taking some shit real seriously. But yeah, I don't know. I liked the free exchange of ideas. What drove me nuts more than anything was there became so much sort of like-mindedness after a while. It was sort of like, when I saw Youth of Today, they opened up for Reagan Youth and they just sort of, it was at Danceteria and they just showed up. I didn't know who they were because I was there for Reagan Youth, right? This was like December of 86 or something, I forget, or 87. And they just blew me away. And I was not straight edge at the time, but just their ferocity and sounding like New York meets SSD and just they're super fit and Ray's an incredible front man. And that was great. And you pair that with Reagan Youth and that's even better. And if you pair it with like, you know what I mean? And then it became like Youth of Today plays with Youth of Today Junior and Youth of Today Junior Junior. And you know, I was just like, and then it was like, are you in the club or are you not in the club? And it sort of got a little clicky feeling, right? And like, you know, even cheesy shit was happening where it was like, hey, our record's going to come out and we're taking pictures. So everybody like get ready, you know? And so all these pictures of these live things are sort of staged. And I refused to take pictures. I was just, my camera would be put down. I'm like, I'm not doing this. Like, I'm not doing this sort of fabricated, we all want to be on the cover of Break Down the Walls. You know what I mean? Like, so I much more enjoy a Born Against going up against a Sick of It All and just hashing it out, right? Like, I just think that's a better use of energy. I don't know.
Yeah, like that's, I feel kind of the same way. It's also, I think, a unique facet of New York, where you know, the storied Nausea, Ray of Today and YDL all living in the same apartment with people from Sci-Fi. Like, it's just like everyone was living in the same sort of apartment. And like, I think that's unique to New York, where all these sort of disparate kind of people can kind of coexist. I think the sense that everyone's living in apartments on top of each other, like you kind of have to put up with your neighbors a little bit more, I think, in New York than other places.
Yeah. I do think the coexisting thing New York had down, right, because you could have like sort of Nazi skinheads, not that there were many, but if there were, there was also the sharp skins that would be like, making sure not. So, but you could leave New York and go to Philly and be like, oh, you got to watch out for the white power skins. You know what I mean? But in New York, it's like too much of a melting pot, right? And any given band on stage is, there's a big chance it wasn't just all white guys, right? And that was a great lesson for me as a suburban kid, you know, where basically the town I grew up in, there was like the white kids and the black kids, and that was it, right? New York was like, these people, like, it was just such a melting pot. It was cool. And it did lend itself to, yeah, like this more tolerance, I guess tolerance is the word. Like, yeah, you just sort of, yeah, otherwise there would have been like wars at every show. You know what I mean? But yeah, like YDL play with Nausea and everybody goes home.
Yeah. I don't see that happening.
I was not into YDL's messaging at all.
No, that's the interesting thing, because it's not like something that's applicable in the real world, where one side does have Nazis on it and one side doesn't. And like, I know, like, obviously that's an extreme way of looking at YDL's kind of message, but that's the ultimate end game, right? Like, that's how it all plays out. And so it is, It is interesting. Going back to New Jersey, though, were you like into the Mother Records bands or like aware of that Mother Records stuff at all?
No.
It's such a weird little subsect of New Jersey. Someone's described it as like sort of the really towny kind of punk scene, but it's like the bands like The Worst, Fatal Rage, Chronic Submission.
No. I
It's
was like into like AOD, Bedlam, Sand in the Face. There's like from the New Jersey's Got It comp. Like that was like the pride of Jersey at the time. To me, AOD were like the kings of what we called Jersey hardcore at the time. I even had a jacket where I painted AOD real big on the back.
more than
But then I
mental
quickly
abuse?
got into the
Oh,
New York stuff.
sorry, more than a mental abuse?
More than mental abuse, yeah. No, AOD was it for me, man. They were like Humongous Fungus Among Us. Was it Wacky Hijinks, the other one, I think? Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, they were the shit. I don't know. And there's like a Bedlam song on the Jersey's Got It comp that I loved. But yeah, then I got really into the New York stuff. And New York just, also New York, like, had CBGBs, had some records, had, the Pyramid Club. And, it was just the place to go. Like, even if, like, it was just cool because like I would take the train in, and hang out at Tompkins Square Park or whatever, right? Like it was just a whole experience. And like, you'd see, you'd start to make friends through the scene and you'd see them before the show for a couple hours ahead of time. Like, so I don't know, there's just a whole thing to it, right? Like there was a real, I mean, it's a community, I guess, which is not a word I don't throw around a lot, but yeah, there's sort of a magical time.
It feels like it's also like a really unique, like we talked about, like the intermingling of worlds that happens there, but also like just it's very different than a lot of the other sort of scenes that pop up around America. To this day, it's kind of different, I guess, because of the way that city functions, and it just has to be kind of different.
Yeah, and I just think it's also remarkable how many bands from that time got really big. To me, I felt a little bit like we're living our Discord, even with Revelation Records coming out. I was like, oh, now it's like, it totally was like I was having like a Discord sort of out of body experience. I'm like, the Warzone 7-inch is like, like even like the fact that they're like Xerox and folded in half, and like the sound quality is shitty, like and then eventually it gets better and the color starts to be introduced and Gorilla Biscuits is sort of the minor thread of Revelation and the whole thing.
Well, yeah, like you look at the Together comp and then like the
Yeah.
aesthetics of the early Boiling Point, like Boiling Point 2.5 and Boiling Point like 1, you kind of see a graphic similarity, and it does feel
Yeah.
like that was the thing about like Youth Crew. I think that's why it does eventually break off and become this kind of unique thing, because it did have a defined aesthetic graphically, fashion wise, sonically
Oh, for
too.
sure. Yeah, I know it's funny because like in some ways like I perpetuated that, right? Like I did these Gorilla Biscuits shirts, the first ones, and like I was literally just a kid who took silk screening class. Gorilla Biscuits was might have been my favorite band at the time, and I'm like, I'm gonna make shirts. Okay, so we started taking pictures. I've got this killer picture of them. I'm gonna put that on the back. Gonna surround it with the words Gorilla Biscuits, the front giant GB. I've got this cool gorilla that Alex drew that I found on a flyer or something. Put that on the front, and then these become like a thing, like a look almost, right? And then other bands want that too. They want like, so oh, another band will put the shirt, the picture on the back or whatever, and it became sort of a thing, right? But the funny thing is, by the time I was in bands, I was like, I'm so done with this. I don't want glory photos, like. So with No Escape, it was like, oh, let's put a nice blurry, weird photo on the cover instead of like, yeah, just because I don't know, you do something long enough, you want to pivot, or at least I did, but the scene didn't really want to pivot. The scene wanted to kind of just continue the pep rally.
I love that kind of like in the same way that I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that happens kind of 83, 84 in hardcore as people kind of leave it to do other
Right.
stuff, Dinosaur Jr. and all that kind of wave of stuff that kind of comes out of it. I think you kind of get that again like 90, 91, where the Youth Crew bubble kind of bursts and like there's a lot of post Youth Crew aesthetic shifts and musically too. I'm really, I love that period. Like, I find the rejection of youth group really interesting.
Well, it's funny because it's interesting you bring that up, right? Because when Quicksand and Burn came out, I was like, oh, this is cool. Rev is sort of entering this like Dag Nasty phase of, like, again, I'm making these parallels because I can't help it. Because that's how to me, I'm like, there was like the obvious first iteration of Discord, and then there was like Right to Spring and Embrace, and it led to sort of then Dag Nasty. All that stuff was a little bit like phase two, right? All these guys did a second band and progressed, but in a way that's cool, not in a way that's lame. I was like, I feel like Quicksand did that and Burn did that, and then I'm not sure really. And then, Iceburn was like delightfully sort of weird, and like Farside is pretty cool. Sensefield killed for less. There's a period where it was, and then I think it sort of reverted back to a lot of Judge Junior stuff. Like people figure there's like a formula that a bunch of people like grew up on and wanted it to do themselves, sort of live that dream for themselves or something. And like, I don't want to judge it. I just didn't want to be a part of it. You know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting because you're back on Revelation with Kiss It Goodbye just in
Right.
time for the youth crew revival. Like, perfectly timed for, yeah,
Yeah.
the next crop of bands that were kind of trying to bring it back. And it's interesting because it's like sort of this pendulum that constantly swings back and forth, right? Where you have like bands kind of getting bored with it, chased out of because of violence. Like, it's interesting you make the parallel with Revelation and Discord. Because it's almost like you could look at ABC No Rio as being the Revolution summer moment for
Yeah.
New York. And that kind of constantly seems to happen where you like the for whatever reason, people kind of turn their back on quote unquote capital H hardcore, and then there has to be another wave of kids that are like, no, we're gonna bring it back. Like we're the this is the true thing. And then they eventually have to get bored with it and they have to kind of do something else, right?
Yeah, for sure. No, that's interesting that the ABC No Rio thing. Yeah, because I was a part of that too. Like that was really cool. And like what was really cool was like there's like the goofy bands that played and it was like a goofier atmosphere, but still really cool bands like Burn played there a lot, Crackdown, Citizens Arrest, Quicksand. I think Quicksand's first official show was at ABC No Rio. Because I think it was booked as Moondog, and then I remember Walter, and I have pictures of this show. And I remember Walter showing up, and I think they had made, because I think he was showing me that they had just made shirts and it said Quicksand. I was like, what is, I was like, I thought you guys were Moondog. He's like, yeah, no, lineup, a little bit of a lineup change, and now they're Quicksand. And yeah, so that was a cool sort of second act for the whole thing. And Walter, to his credit, was a as big part of that as I think he could be, as far as someone who really did come from being king of the hill with the whole CB scene. I always thought that was really cool of him to try to be a part of that. Yeah.
Yeah, like
I'm not
I
even
think
sure.
it. Sorry, go on.
I'm not even sure I'm answering a question, but we're just riffing.
No, absolutely. And I think that's the, well, I think that's the point of the show too. But I feel like that's the moment you have in New York where, obviously, things start shifting in CBGB stuff, and there's like a change in the guard kind of. But you look at that where all the children now comp, and there's
All
like
right.
awesome stuff on that, the Moondog stuff. I was working with Walter a couple of years ago and trying to put out the Moondog record at a record label and just trying to
No
nail
way.
down the timeline on when Moondog stops or when Gorilla Biscuits stops and Moondog kind of starts and then when Moondog transitions into Quicksand. It's like a real hard thing to kind of pin down with that guy sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the Moondog show at CB's. I have a couple of pictures, and it's Luke on bass and Howie on guitar. And I think Tom Capone was already on guitar, but Sergio was not in it. And I don't know, Alan might have played drums because Luke was not playing drums. It was a funny lineup. But I remember liking it. Like I remember like I didn't my first time hearing it was seeing him at CB's. I remember liking it. So I was really curious what Walter was gonna be like live. Or even just what his voice sounded like. Like nobody knew then, right? And it was cool. Yeah, and then like next thing I know, it was like Sergio's on bass and Howie and Luke are not in the band and they sound a little bit different. But yeah, I always liked it. I don't know. But yeah, it's still sort of a mystery to me, like what is Moondog in all of this? Yeah.
There is like a LP worth of songs. And
wow.
Yeah, it got put out a couple years ago, like as an MP3 only. When I say a couple years ago, like 20 years ago now, but as an MP3 only type release. Huh. And Walter's just decided that's going to be his like lost album out there. And there's a bootleg that I think the guy from Food Swings put out back in the early 90s. And then there was a, like the one song on that comp, I guess, Where Are the Children Now comp. And that's kind of it. But yeah, I love that stuff. To me, it's like, well, obviously it's the bridge, but it's the perfect bridge between Gorilla Biscuits and Quicksand.
Right. I haven't listened to that one. I forgot that it was on that. Cause I remember that guy, I think it was like the guy, I think Melinda Beck did the cover. I'm trying to remember. I remember watching the thing happen. Like, cause I worked at Venus Records and the guy put it out.
I think there's two covers, right? There's like a screened cover of the kids, so, yeah. And then there's like another version too, right?
That rings a bell. It's, yeah, we're going back a lot of years.
Well, going back a little bit further, were there other records you wanted to put out on Irate Records?
Hard to say. Like the Irate, that comp was actually announced in Boiling Point. And so I think I'd already collected a couple of those songs. And it was going to come out on Boiling Point, but then Boiling Point by then was sort of defunct. Because I had started No Escape, if I'm getting the chronology right. So what I quickly found out was, like, it's a lot of fucking work, like, to put out a record. And then I drove up and down the East Coast, basically giving record stores my record. And then they'll be like, yeah, come back to get money someday. You know what I mean? And I'm like, fuck, now I got to drive back to, like, fucking D.C. to this tiny little record store that I just gave, like, 15 records to. To try to hopefully get 40 bucks from that, and then they'll want more, right? Like, it was just like a lot of work. Or, and mail order sucks. Like, you know, that's a pain in the fulfillment is from hell. So I think I quickly was like, I'm going to just focus on my band and, you know, sell demos at the shows. Like, that's much easier.
How much did you press that? Because it was like 1,000 or more.
Yeah, it was pressed twice. So it might be 1,000. I probably sold it at shows. That must have been how, or I think, you know, different people probably, like, Very Distribution might have picked it up. Who knows? I don't really remember, but I do remember, you know, it was a great lineup.
It
was,
oh, it's crazy.
It was easy to sell. It just wasn't easy to, like, distribute, you know, like, for me. Like, I didn't do it with anybody else. So it was me and my car, you know, and if there wasn't a show, like, I'm trying to go to record stores and get them to pick it up. And, you know, there's only a handful. And yeah, and so that was just like a lot of work. And like, I think I might have kept going with it because I was well connected enough to enough bands where I probably could have figured something out. But, you know, I quickly had my own bands to focus on, which was my sort of ultimate goal after a while, was like to have my own band. Sort of, you know, sort of create your own content, right? Like, so that's where that went.
Yeah, because you guys, like, I was always wondering why you didn't do the No Escape records, because I guess the Turning Point split comes out just after, or around
that. Yeah, we lived with Chuck Miller, right, who was really into starting a record label. And so he handled all the ugly stuff, right? I still designed it. I still got to be on it, you know. I just didn't have to handle the logistics, which was way better for me. You know, it's hard enough, like, printing, like, you know, designing the No Escape demo, and, like, I would, like, print out the demo sleeves and cut them out with X-Acto knives and fold them for shows, you know, that kind of shit. That was enough. Like, if someone else can handle their, like, distribution and selling and getting the money, cool. I'll just, you know, work on making songs.
But you were also doing logos for other bands at this point too, right? Like, did you do the Resurrection logo, or?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what would happen is, like, I know different people, and, like, every once in a while someone would ask me to, like, either make a shirt or design a record. So that inevitably meant I'm probably going to make a logo for you, right? Like, that's how the Burn logo happened, right? It was just a think it was I think Alan knew me because I had done Beyond Sure, and Alan used for briefly lived on my sofa for like a week in Brooklyn. That's how we met. Yeah, I think it was like he had started Burn. I mean, I knew Gavin too, but I'm pretty sure it was Alan that asked me to like do Burn shirts, and they had nothing, right? So I was like, well, I'm just gonna, you know, figure out a Burn logo and make a. That's funny because back then too, I just sort of did it. I don't even know if I ran the logo by the band. I think I probably just showed up with shirts. You know what I mean? Like it's just how shit happened back then. Like the Gorilla Biscuit shirt that I did, like I wore it to a show. Walter saw me wearing it and then asked me to make it for the band because I made it for myself. Like there was like a two, you know what I mean? So that's just how shit happened. Like Resurrection was like the same thing. I was like, they needed a logo. I even took like promo pictures of them because I had a camera, like the whole, you know, I laid out. I think there's a Chris Tolliver photo of a TV for the cover. I don't know, I started doing that more and more, but it's like once you're in your own band, you kind of want to do it less and less for other bands, you know? Kind of want to almost like save your ammo for yourself.
It's so important though, because you like think about every band that's kind of memorable versus the bands that aren't really remembered. Like the strong graphic sense is so key.
Yeah, and I probably would have done it for a living if there was a living to be had. But asking bands for money is like getting blood from a stone. Some, you know what I mean? And you feel bad. Like, I don't want to ask my punk band friends for money. Like, you know, like I know how broke we all are. So it's like, it didn't strike me as a career path, even though I sort of wanted it to be. Like in my mind, it could have been like in some really extrapolated way, you know, but, I don't know. I was like, I just turned all that energy into making my own stuff. You know, instead of like being this hired gun for all these other bands.
I think Raymond Pettibon would probably be the first guy to tell you that you kind of have to use that for the jumping off point to something else. Cause I don't think he got paid very much from his brother from the sounds of
his. Yeah, I don't imagine. Yeah, exactly.
Because you weren't putting out the records yourselves, you do wind up putting out a record on Overkill Records, Ron Brotherhood's label. Yeah. Rest in peace. A really underrated label.
Yeah. I mean, Ron, it's funny because I saw the letter from him that he wrote when he heard Dead Guy. Like, he's just a great guy. And my stepbrother moved out. Dennis, who started the zine, moved out to Seattle late 80s, early 90s, something like that. And, like, ended up being really good friends with Greg Anderson and Ron. And I think the guy who plays bass for Foo Fighters, like, that
Nate. Whole crew.
Yeah, Nate. Yeah, yeah.
I was doing research for this episode and sent him a photo of the Galleon's Lap interview.
Oh, wow. From,
Boiling Point issue number 5.
Yeah, Galleon's Lap. Yeah. Greg Anderson, man. Engine Kid. Like, I loved all that shit. I love Greg Anderson. But
it's interesting when you look at Galleon's Lap and you think, man, there's Sun O and the Foo Fighters in this emo band.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Like, all this, like, yeah, Dennis was there for like a magical, like he saw, this is a sidebar, but you know, Dennis was out there, sees Nirvana play at OK Hotel, and then they have to, because it's a bar, everybody had to leave at a certain time, but Nirvana's like, if you come back after hours or whatever it is, we're going to play our new record. So my stepbrother Dennis got to go back and see Nevermind played. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
This like amazing piece of like rock and roll history or something. So he was in the middle of all of that. But anyway, Ron was just, Ron, the No Escape record was like posthumous, but Ron wanted to put it out anyway. And I just love Ron. I'd met him a couple of times and chatted with him when he was in that really SSD Brotherhood. Yeah, that's how I first chatted with him. He's just a great guy. So it just felt like, okay, that's cool. Someone wants to actually document all the No Escape stuff and put it out. And, but it's funny because like when I first listened to it, actually I was at Rutgers. I remember getting a copy of the CD and playing it at the Dead Guy house. like, because it was already in Dead Guy by the time it came out. So it's, you know, there's so much overlap. Like, you just go beyond to the next thing.
I thought it was so cool that you guys do a Big Boys cover on it.
Yeah, that was Steve-O's idea. I'll give him credit for that. Like, we wanted to do an atypical cover, right? And it's funny because, like, in a way, we almost were like, and this is going to piss off Maximum Rock and Roll. How dare these fucking kids from the hardcore scene, the youth crew hardcore scene, which we were trying so hard not to be from in a way. But, you know, it was marketed back then as like Tim Boyle Point is in a band with Steve from Turning Point. So it was like, you know, we were already pigeonholed. But yeah, he suggested it. We all heard it. We're like, this is fucking great. We can destroy this. We can make it our own, right? We're not going to sound like the Big Boys. But yeah, I think I'd been in bands for all of 6 weeks at that time, like six or six. Like, it was recorded so early on. I had no idea what I was doing, but it was fun.
Yeah, I like it because it does kind of, it has that continuity to punk and yeah. Does, you know, like, it's like, I don't know, anytime you see that stuff, like, there's like this pressing of Can't Close My Eyes where Ray and Porcel and all those guys wrote their favorite punk 7 inches and are talking about Devo and Buzzcocks Records on the labels of the single. And it's like, I love that because hardcore and punk are best when they're kind of mixed together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, I don't typically sing the way I do on that Big Boys cover, right? Like, it's not so easy. Like, you know, and it's like, I'm like, this is kind of a fun thing, a little bit outside of my lane. To the outsider, it wouldn't sound that different, right? But to me, I'm like, that was really me sort of stretching.
Yeah, no, I get it. I 100% get that vibe too. And it's like, and that's the thing, is like, sometimes you get in your lane in this thing and you're like, yeah, I can flex. I can go some other places.
Yeah.
No reason, yeah, cool. I can't. Did you guys No Escape tour much at all?
No, we did one national tour, but you know, we recorded the song Silence within 16 days of my first practice, right? So we just went fast. Then we quickly recorded like this 5-song demo, and then we quickly played like the Anthrax opening for Burn and Quicksand. So we just hit the ground running, right? I mean, I think our fourth and fifth shows were like at Spanky's in California, playing with like Statue and Chain of Strength and shit like that. So we had these like sort of highly targeted, really cool shows, not by design really. And so it felt like we hit the ground running, and we were like well received from day one. So like, and so all our shows were just, they were all like kind of good shows. Like, we didn't do any like really downer shows that earn our stripes. Like, we sort of started on the second, you know, we started on third base, you know what I mean? Like, we were just playing great shows, and we were like, you know, getting great attention, selling shirts, and you know, we do this. And even our national tour was great. Nothing fell apart really. And it was with Worlds Collide and Railhead, and that was pretty awesome. And when we were in California, we played with like Born Against, you know, like, it was just like everything was aligned. We played with Carrie Nation when we were in like Omaha, like everything was sort of aligned nicely. And then those guys wanted me to sing. Like, Steve-O decided that I was the problem, like that I was somehow holding him back. And I was like, fine. The feedback I get is that people sort of like, sometimes they like us despite the fact that you're trying to rock out, but whatever, you do you. I'm going to go do me. You know, we parted ways sort of amicably. I think they tried to play one or two shows without me with Zach, the drummer from Worlds Collide, who sang for Seven Gone or whatever it was. And he sang sort of Layne Staley-ish, right? Sort of Alice in Chains-ish. So that was making Steve-O very happy. I think Jason Farrell might have even designed their record. Like, they were trying to do all the things they wanted to do. And I wanted to do the opposite. I wanted to make Black Flag Damage sound like a pop record. You know what I mean? Like, so that's just, you know, definite fork in the road.
Yeah, like, it's, you brought up that Nirvana show that Dennis went to, and that's such like an interesting moment where all of a sudden it went from being this thing that really had no stakes to being this thing which had an upside. Right. and bands were getting signed, right? Like Quicksand got signed. Like, you know, maybe if you did sing, maybe like I'm not, obviously I'm completely in your boat. Like I'd be like, fuck you, I'm not singing. But I think like I could see why bands all of a sudden were like, oh shit, well, maybe Island Records will put this out.
Right. My whole thing was like, I'll talk to any label on our terms. Like, I'm not here to be some, like, it's just like, it's not what got me into this. Life's too short. Plus, I can't do it. Like, it's not a skill I have. So I don't want to be like some miserable trained monkey trying to, like, you know, it's like, nah, there's people better suited for that stuff. Like, you know, if I could sing like that, I would have figured it out by now. So.
Yeah, like, and I guess Quicksand obviously gets some success, but like the most successful band out of this would probably be what, Rage Against the Machine?
Right, yeah.
And it wasn't like he was singing, he went the opposite way with it.
It's like a hip hop, but
Yeah.
yeah, I remember Alan again from Burn, and he's out of Burn at that time, and he's in Quicksand. I was going to see Quicksand at City Gardens, and they had just finished a tour with Rage, but I hadn't heard them yet. Right, Rage just in my mind was like, oh, Zach from Inside Out. They're calling him like DJ Zach because he started this hip hop thing that's like funky or something. And Alan's like, all right, look, it is hip hop, sort of funk rock, but I'm telling you, it's fucking amazing. And I'm like, are you sure? And then the copy of the first record, like in the used bin at like Venus Records, like one of those like promotional copies, not for sale kind of things. And I was like, oh, this is fucking cool. Like, I loved it, you know? And it sort of to me was like, and he's not, he doesn't, you know, they're not trying to rock out. They're not trying to like ride the grunge train or what, you know what I mean? Like, it just was like, it's refreshingly different, you know? Like, nobody sounded like that yet, you know?
Yeah, the grunge thing was a real divide. Well, obviously issue number five that I keep going back to, Boiling Point. Like there's a letter, I think it's in the next issue. There's like a letter section where people are like really pissed
Yeah.
about the change in it. And like and Nate from actually the Foo Fighters, when he was on, talked about going to see Nirvana and being like, oh, they just sounded like Led Zeppelin to me.
Right.
And
Interesting.
it was like I don't know, like it's because obviously it changed everything, right? Like there was and to this day, like I think it changes. I don't think we'd live in this world where you'd have a turnstile in these places without Nirvana kind of being that band that first crosses
Yeah.
over like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, I remember when Nirvana got. I was a big Nirvana fan when they were on Sub Pop. Like, you know, Soundgarden and Nirvana. It's funny. And I would argue both bands got better after they got signed, which broke the mold, right? Like, but I remember talking to Steve-O from No Escape. We're like driving to practice, and we had heard Nirvana got signed to Geffen or whatever. And we were like, I was like, I don't. I was like, what's that all about? Is that like a tax write-off for Geffen? Or are they just like throwing money at something? You know what I mean? I'm like, I love Nirvana, but like, I don't see like regular people loving Nirvana. And what the fuck did I know? Right? Like, yeah. Because I remember Smells Like Teen Spirit comes, like the album came out. I went to see them in New York and maybe City Gardens. And the album's out. You know, never mind. But nobody, it hadn't blown up yet. So you could still go see them at medium-sized clubs, right? And just felt like, oh, they have a record out and it's good and cool. You know, it's like popular than the first record and it's got more range than maybe I expected. And then I remember like Headbangers Ball or whatever, the After Midnight thing. They played Smells Like Teen Spirit and I recorded it on my VCR because like I might never see this again, right? You know? And that song became America's new national anthem for like, you know, forever. And then now I'm hearing it come out of frat boys' cars, you know. I'm
Yeah.
like, what the fuck's that? And Rage Against the Machine is like coming out of like frat parties, you know. I'm like, what's going on? You know,
Yeah,
and it was like Beastie Boys probably paved the way with that, with Fight for Your Right to Party. That was probably the first real, you know, entering the broader vernacular of just American bro-ism, you know? But yeah.
I think Nirvana and Rage Against the Machine, more than the Beastie Boys, I think the Beastie Boys got conscious a little bit later on, but I feel like those two bands, Zach DeLaRocca and Kurt Cobain, both got to the top of the mountain and realized like, oh yeah, it's not about platform. It's not about getting out there to these masses. These kids will ignore everything you're saying, no matter how clearly you're
Once you're a
saying it.
commodity, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It, speaking of which, you did a record on Lost and Found record. No Escape did a record on Lost and Found. Was that a legit release or was that like one of those Lost and Found? It shows up on Lost and
That's like
Found.
the split with what's on the
It's a
other
split
side?
with Bonesaw, maybe?
I
Which is also very
bet
bizarre.
you, I'm pretty sure Steve gave them permission. And it was that simple. And like I never got caught up in that stuff. I never, to me, I'm like, hey, if more people want to hear it and it's gonna reach people overseas, whatever it is, cool. Like that was always my mindset with that stuff. Like if people want to borrow my silk screens and make more shirts, cool, right? Like I just always that was always to me, it was all open source. So like I think it's pretty legit. Steve-O could answer that for real. But I'm pretty sure he gave permission for that. Yeah, because he was eager to have that stuff come out on anything at all times.
Yeah, it seems like there's always permission, but whether that comes from a band member or a roadie, that
Right.
is where there's some discrepancies.
It wasn't explicitly me, but I think the understanding with me is that I'm always okay with it, so.
Yeah, Lost and Found and Mystic seem to have the reputation for, like as long as you're okay with it, because no matter what, it's going to come out.
And what the only thing that'll annoy me is like if they don't send me shit. I'm like, you could at least send me some shit. You're gonna sell my shit. But so I do have one copy of that 7-inch, and I'm not sure if they sent it to me. I think they might have, because I don't remember where else I would have gotten it from. But yeah,
It
that
it's
was a long
funny.
time ago.
It's funny in this era where like bootleggers have Instagram accounts and are like advertising the bootleg drop versus where people are burning the numbers off the record or making sure that no one found the screens ever.
Because there's people do that with t-shirts too, right? And it's like these limited drops and yeah. I'm actually trying to get a Minor Threat shirt from a guy who did that. It was like the Minor Threat shirt that was always on sale at Bleecker Bob's and I used to have. It was never their shirt, but it was just like one of the official Minor Threat bootleg shirts,
Probably produced by Lost and Found or Mystic Records or something.
Exactly.
It's definitely a it was well, it's interesting like because this stuff becomes a commodity both in its actual representation but just even like graphically. Like how many of those Misfits skull shirts sold over the years were actually made by the Misfits, but like they were making somebody money.
I know, and the irony there is like the Misfits are great at stealing that artwork in the first place.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe they can't complain. I think they're all doing fine anyway at this point, selling out Madison Square Garden.
That's the thing about punk rock. It's like such a postmodern thing. Like I went and saw Green Day the other day, and they're playing like they played. He starts playing "Summer of '69," like Billy Joe Armstrong, the riff, and singing "Summer of '69." Then they go into a Green Day song, and it gets to the breakdown. And the riff is completely lifted from Summer of '69 that he had just played before the song, almost
Amazing.
pre-foretelling, like, here's where I got the sample from that you're about to hear. And it's like, oh yeah, this whole genre is based on lifting riffs and
I mean, I
graphics.
saw you had Frank Black on, right? And he
Yeah.
was saying how it all sort of ended with Minor Threat. And that did get me thinking, where, because I love art history. I loved it in college. And don't quote me on any art history now, but I always, to me, it's the same as, like Van Gogh being inspired by stuff coming from Japan, or even Frank Miller, if you want to get more modern, right? Getting inspired by Japanese comics, whatever. I feel like Minor Threat took it to this point, and now we're all postmodern. Now we're all sampling. And it's funny because I always sort of enjoy it. Like I might lift a phrase like I Wish I, which is like an Embrace song. Like I might just borrow those three words to do something. Right, like so for me, I'm like we are in this sort of era where, like, I mean, I guess there's probably a band that could try to play a song in 3 seconds and to get, maybe it's Infest or something, but yeah, I feel like we're sort of in this postmodern, which I think is cool though. I think there's so much now that's been created that now you can, but to me, that's what the Dead Kennedys were doing, right? It's like surf punk meets political protests. Like, you know, I just love that kind of shit. I don't
know. Yeah. I think even Minor Threat was too. Like, I feel like, to me, SSD almost might be the first band that really broke from it, because Al Brill like hated punk. He didn't only wanted to sound like hardcore. And then I feel like what you guys are doing, like I always looked, especially Kiss Goodbye. I'm a fan of it. Like, I love the new Dead Guy record obviously as well, but I mean, like when that Kiss Goodbye record came out kind of at the height of bringing it back style hardcore, or Cry on the Floor emo too. And it was something that didn't sound like Dead Guy necessarily, but sounded like new. Like I was like, oh yeah, there still can be innovation in this stuff. And like you said, Infest or, there are bands every once in a while that I feel like still kind of kick the ball forward a little bit.
Yep. And I'm always interested to find out how that's done. Right. That someone's going to surprise me. I kind of love that. Right. Yeah. It doesn't always have to be ugly. Like, I feel like my lane is to try to make things not even ugly, just less polished or less, smoothed around the edges. Like we like to be a hard swallow, right? Like a tough pill to swallow. Like I sort of like that, right? Like I like that about Rollins Band, it's not supposed to be for everybody. Although nowadays I feel like it's funny because sort of become a genre, right? Like now I'm 56, new Dead Guy record comes out. My kids are the same age I was when I was doing all this. And they don't listen to this stuff the way I did. It's just another channel in Spotify, right? It's a lane, right? Like they'll listen to Charlie SCX and then they'll listen to, I don't know, something super heavy. And it's like, to them, it's like all the same sort of commodity in a way,
Yeah.
It's just a different little square playlist in Spotify or something. Yeah. It's interesting. It's changed a lot.
Yeah, it's changed a lot, but I feel like the one thing that does kind of survive is that there is this, like I went with my youngest kid, not that by their choosing, they're only 9 years old, so they did not want to actually go here, but I dragged him along because I was going to sing with this band Restraining Order, who are a younger band in the sense that they're younger than me, and going to that show and realizing, holy shit, I think this is the first time I've been at a hardcore show where I'm one of the 10 oldest people in the room. And it's still happening. Like they might not get to it the same way that I got to it, but like they're still in this warehouse in something that's not being covered or sponsored or just wiling out to bands doing the same SSD covers that everyone's been doing for all these years too.
No, there's something really magical about that, I think. And I think it almost has more meaning in some ways, or heightened meaning, because everything is so packaged and channeled to you, right? And you can still go to a hardcore show, punk show, whatever, and be surprised and be confronted with something that you may never have heard before, or even have an experience you just didn't anticipate, right? Like there's something super cool about that.
But going back to it, almost feels like in the late 90s there was like a scene that did really, because there wasn't a defined aesthetic, or maybe there wasn't a defined media to kind of link it together. It kind of all was like these sort of like little disparate pockets, but you look at where in particular metal, but aggressive music is gone. And it's really like that 90s scene was like the germination point, like Burn the Priest or like the pre-Mastodon bands or like the power violence stuff or like the noisecore stuff that was happening too. Like there's just like there was like this really cool underground scene happening across North America, and there's bands in England and Australia doing it too, like across the world actually, but there wasn't like a place that you can really see it all brought together other than zines being like, this is happening. There's this band called I Hate God, and there's this band called Dead Guy, and they're all cool, and it's it's not posse, and it's not emo, it's like this other thing.
Right. Yeah, it's funny because like I came from the pure hardcore scene, so like the metal thing was like the other guys, like they were into that. Like, and it's funny because like they're Like, I'm the older guy in the band, not even that much older, but by high school standards, I'm the older guy in the band, right? And I grew up on, and I also, because my brother's 4 years older, so I was playing Kraut and Cause for Alarm and that kind of, growing up on that kind of stuff, right? And those guys were like really into like the Jersey metal stuff, that I can't even think, think of the band's names, but that's what was really influencing them. And they came, they just sort of discovered hardcore through this other route, through sort of metal, right? Where I discovered metal by being in hardcore bands with guys who like metal. And like, because like, I don't know, all the hair band shit, those are the guys that I was having fights with in high school. Like all the Motley Crue dipshits and their whole look drove me crazy. I was never into like Alice Cooper or any of that stuff. So to me, they were like the natural enemy. And so it's kind of funny. Like Anthrax was like one of the exceptions because they seemed like hardcore guys in a metal band. And then Metallica was like an exception because they wrote smart lyrics. Like, so there's a couple of like exceptions. And then Slayer was sort of just undeniable, right? Like once someone turned me on to Slayer, I was like, oh yeah, this makes a lot of hardcore bands seem like fucking Goldilocks. Like, so yeah, but and now it's funny, like I love the metal scene. Like metal, like you said, like it just kept getting cooler. Like I don't know, it branched like crazy. But there's something about metal shows that we play at least where it's like you don't feel judged. It's not as cliquey. There's no one trying to be king of the pit. You know what I mean? And there's like, and there could be like crazy shoegazy stuff going on, really theatrical stuff going on. And everybody's there for it. Like it's kind of cool. Like we played some of these really big fests, and it's just like everybody's there for it. Like it's kind of cool.
Yeah, Randy from Lamb of God, when he was on here, talked about how there was like this sort of second wave of crossover, second wave of American crossover, and that's what you're seeing the fruits of now. And it's yeah, it's really, it is like, it's cool because it is a scene that just feels completely counter to, like, because I was the same way. I hated metal as a kid, and I didn't even make that any of those exceptions till much later. Like, I was like, I just didn't, I had such an aversion to it because it was just sort of this like impenetrable rock He-Man toy kind of presentation of stuff.
I was like, how can you guys not write cool lyrics? And like, why is it stupid? It doesn't need to be stupid. Like,
Was that part of the reason that you guys went on Engine Records as opposed to Blackout Records, like not wanting to necessarily be associated with anything else?
yeah, but that was more Bill Wilson. I think he wanted Engine to be like not like I think he wanted something. That's the owner of the label. I think he wanted it to be something that wasn't gonna be lumped in with a bunch of, especially I think. And Dick has been very conscious of this. I never want to come across as like a tough guy band. Like we have a tough sound, and I sing about tough things maybe, but not tough in a macho way. Tough in like I like to confront this mental breakdown that we're all sharing, right? Like I feel like I'm a good channeler of that, and like the stuff that's in your head or you might not want to always say out loud or you wish someone else would say out loud. I feel like that's our role, but we're not on a soapbox about it, and we're not tough about it. So like, and maybe Bill Wilson sort of understood that about us. Like we just didn't feel like a cookie. We were not a New York hardcore band. I feel like Blackout was like New York hardcore, and if you put us out on Blackout, I think it would have put that halo over us or whatever in a way that might have gotten us a little misconstrued. Whatever. So that might be why. I don't know why. We didn't really have a conversation about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because I think that guy's almost like a victim of never being on like the appropriate label until now, I guess. Relapse actually makes a lot of sense given like the current Relapse roster, but like obviously Victory is Victory, and an Engine Blackout like doesn't really fit. Like it's almost like if you guys could been on, I don't know, like AMRep maybe or something. Yeah, like.
But AMRep would have missed the entire hardcore. Like AMRep didn't get it. Like we would play shows with Today's the Day, and I think we introduced them to a hardcore crowd that they never would have discovered otherwise, right? So there was no happy place for us, I think, because I reached out to Rev. Like to me, Kiss Goodbye being on Rev was because they missed the boat with Dead Guy. And they were like, oh, well, okay, we'll just do Tim's next band then. Because, like, basically, I remember talking to Jordan. I think it was Jordan. And he's like, I think I'm going to – I said, like, I get it. I get where you're coming from, but I think I'm going to have to pass. Because he sort of didn't understand it, you know. And he's on the West Coast. And because I've known him since he put out the first records, like, because I worked at Venus Records and I hung out at some records. So I've known – Jordan's a friend of mine to this day, you know. So it was nothing personal. It was more like he just didn't get it. He didn't know what to do with it. It was just – it was kind of just too different, you know. I was like, okay, that sucks. Whatever. Not that sucks, but, you know, my dream back then was to be on – it was like almost to be on a Discord band if I was from D.C. To be on Rev would have just checked the box for me, you know, personally. And I'd never even heard of Victory Records until, like, I heard they were going to put a record out. Like, they were, like, this new label I sort of heard of, you know. But whatever, they were willing to put money into it and, like, all that kind of stuff. So we were like, cool, someone will actually finally put this fucking record out that we recorded and have been sitting on, you know.
Well, it's interesting because, like, the time when you guys signed Victory Records being – and the time – when it quickly morphs into whatever it morphs into, it's a very short period of time, but like prior to your guys' record, it's a very different label than it would become. And then ultimately turns into some weird ass shit. But
yeah, I mean, I only met Tony once, you know, the tour that broke up Dead Guy 1.0. One of the reasons we broke up, I would say, is because the record wasn't out. Right. And so we toured on nothing. We toured on 2 7-inches that people barely had. And that made it very hard for a, you know, a tour in 1994, three or whatever it was. you know, pre-cell phone, pre-internet, it was just like a hard thing to pull off in it. And, you know, we were all young and dumb. So I barely, you know, we get back, basically break up. So I never really dealt with Tony. I met him in Chicago on the way home, I think. And that was about it. So I didn't pay much attention, you know. I always heard stories about them, sort of kept my distance. And how's that?
I have two records. I have like an Even Score 7-inch where he's photocopied the sleeve and there's a note on the back talking about how Action Pack Records have fucked them over too long. And so now he's going to go and form Victory Records. And then I have a Skeen 7-inch. Where I guess they were doing a pressing of it. And anyway, there's a note to the poor kid that ordered the 7-inch from Tony on Victory Records letterhead saying that because he's been fucked over too hard by Skeen Records, he's now going to form Victory Records. So it's ironic that he would then be screwing over a band on tour, but not having their record on.
No, he didn't screw us over though, to be fair. It was Engine couldn't pay for it. So we went and recorded it. Engine couldn't, we had to get off of Engine, and Victory basically bought it out.
Okay.
So he didn't fuck us for that. It was just that I never had dealings with him because we broke up basically before, you know, and then, but I did hear like, you know, after I left, like Dead Guy actually wanted to change the name, but he was like, do that, I'm not giving you any support or anything. So that's why Dead Guy kept the name basically. He wanted to hold on to it.
Did you get a Dead Guy watch ever?
No, I didn't even know they existed.
Yeah, they've got the Victory magazine, which I'm telling you, like, talk about a great cultural artifact. And in it, there's like merch catalogs, and they're made every piece of merch imaginable for every single band on the label. Like, I can't imagine a Hi-Fi and the Roadburners watch was ever a hot seller, but right. It was available.
Huh. I'm gonna look into that to see if they ever got past the prototype. Because like there is a single Kiss It Goodbye snowboard.
Whoa.
Like they made a prototype and then they never did anything, but my friend in Seattle still has it. He promised to mail it to me, he still hasn't, but you know.
I'm pretty sure the Dead Guy watch at least sold one because I do remember meeting a kid on tour.
Wow.
Who had a Dead Guy watch.
That's kind of cool.
I think they must have just bought like a bunch of like Swatch knockoffs on bulk, right. Like pre-Timu style, and just put it like Warzone plate.
I want to make one now. Now I feel like somehow a watch, and maybe it's got to be broken or just have nothing but sixes.
It runs backwards.
Yeah, it goes backwards. All right. So you were having a good brainstorming. That's good. I like that.
It feels like, and I don't mean to put this on you, but like every time you kind of get a band that was kind of going, something kind of happens. Like Kiss It Goodbye, it felt like the momentum was just kind of getting going post that LP coming out. And I never got to see you up here, at least. So I don't know how much touring or playing you guys managed to do, but it just felt like it was never sort of capitalized on in sort of a crass way.
You're right. So yeah, with Dead Guy, we just didn't survive that first failed tour. And I was quick to be like, I'm moving to Seattle. And I thought we could continue the band, but that was sort of, a fantasy. And then with Kiss Goodbye, we did a really terrible tour with Obituary. And I was I didn't want to do it. I wanted to do our own tour. Like, I wanted to be like Helmet. Like, we do Kiss Goodbye shows, right? We play this, and this is like a low point for Obituary because the shows are really not attended well, and they're all 21 and over. And I'm like, well, fuck, that turns off so many of our fans, right? And I would meet kids outside of the show. They're like, can't come in, just wanted to come hang out, see you guys, whatever, shit like that, right? And like, our bass player was like making fun of Obituary the whole time, calling them Oshituary. And like, the band caught wind of that pretty quick. Obituary did. And just sent us home. And that took a lot of wind out of our sails. Keith was also super in love with a girl who lived on the East Coast, who he's now married to. So I'm not throwing any shade at him. And he just made a life decision that I'm going to go be with my girl, you know? And then, so Damien replaced him. But we just sort of like ran out of steam. Like, I was like, I think I want to have kids. I think, I've done this forever. My throat always hurts. So it's like, yeah. So, it never became, I think, it was one of those things, like when you're doing it though, you don't know that people are going to feel this way about your records all these years later. Like, I didn't know that people felt that way about Fixation for the longest time until really that once the internet starts happening and I'm on Facebook and then I'm on Instagram and then I got people tagging me all the time and telling me, either reaching out to me because they find me, right? And they write me really nice notes about how much these records meant to them. Or they're tagging me with be like, all these big bands are like wearing our shirts or mentioning us. And I started to get an ink. And then Decibel wants us in their Hall of Fame, And so I started to get a sense that what we did had some impact. But I was just raising my kids, being with my wife, playing Ultimate Frisbee, stuff like that.
It's funny because even getting into it at the time, like around 94, like Fixation was like, oh, Victory sucks, but Fixation is the record. Like, or people like Integrity and Fixation are the records to get on Victory. Like, it felt like right away there was, but there's not really like a scene for Dead Guy to kind of fall into. And in even Kiss It Goodbye a few years later, it's not like you guys could like really like slot into somewhere that's like a perfect fit.
No, I mean, it's like, we were on Rev, but didn't really fit on Rev, like they didn't quite know what to do with us, and like Sub Pop wanted to sign Kiss Goodbye, believe it or not. Like the one guy from Sub Pop is that every time we played in Seattle, he's at our shows and be like, I want you on my label. And I'm like, well, we're on Rev. So we were going to do a Singles of the Month club with them.
I can see that. That makes sense to me. Like, especially like, look at where Piss Jeans winds up and stuff. Like, there is like, it makes more sense in the context of like Mudhoney and Tad than it does, I think.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Like us in the context of Revelation was just tough. Like, it just we were so much heavier and belligerent. I don't know. Like, dark. Compared to like, I remember hearing like Zach heard the record because he would hang out at Revelation, Zach De La Rocha or Roca, whatever it is. And he really liked like the song What If, because it's about cops. And he's like, man, the whole record should be like that, And I was like, that's food for thought. But so I don't know. Yeah, like, no, Kiss Goodbye played cool shows, And it's funny because like now I could see like Kiss Goodbye playing with Obituary and it would make a lot of sense. But back then the scenes were so, there was just a canyon between them and it didn't make sense. Other than like, if you're in bands, like half my band is really excited to go on tour with Obituary. But it didn't really make sense to our fans. I don't think it crossed over to it making sense to our fans yet. Like now it would, you know?
Yeah, like I even like seeing Hatebreed on tour with Slayer back then, it would be like all fights,
right?
Crowd, because it was so like the bands I think got it more than the fan bases did back then.
Now, like if Dead Guy's playing with Obituary, to me, I'm like that makes sense.
Yeah,
like, I can see that.
Yeah,
and we're not gonna get booed off stage or like misunderstood. I think people would be like, oh, that's cool. You know
what I mean? Well, I think like you're saying now, it's just a different stream on your distribution right. service, whereas back then there were real stakes, like you'd have to invest time and money into being in this one thing,
right?
Yeah. Anything that wasn't part of it was really alien.
Yeah, and there's like, and there's even slightly antagonistic, right? Somehow, like there's, especially, you know, like Obituary had a giant tour van and the shows were 21 and over, which was like the antithesis of the scene I came from. So it was like, even that, I think, was like a cultural divide, right?
Yeah, that's why I always found Napalm Death so interesting, because they were like always kind of able to keep one foot in both worlds a little bit.
Yeah. No, they're great. Kiss Goodbye's first shows with them is great, coming out on high. And then our first show back, Dead Guy's first show back at the Fillmore, Napalm Death played, I think, the next night. So it, to me, I'm like, that's sort of this beautiful bookend. And it's just awesome, you know. Them and Converge. Converge is still around doing it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think Converge played No Escape. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's amazing how, like, there are these bands that kind of have this longevity in this scene and are able to kind of put up with each other for that long. Like, I feel like that's something for all of us to try and aspire to, but I don't know if I'll be able to do it. Like, those guys, like, that's like fucking like almost 40 years they've been together.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's cool. I'm sure they pick their times and, you know, then they go about their lives. They're like the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's almost like, and then it's like Jacob's got this sort of like he's got this, like, he's got this sort of trajectory as his lead singer versus like yourself, who's, it's almost like a, like I say, it's almost like a Kubrick kind of approach to being a lead singer, where like you're in different bands. So you're not always doing necessarily the same vocal approach because you're writing with different people.
Right.
But there's always going to be sort of this progression, like John Brandon, like we're talking about the John Brandon thing, or like at the start of this conversation, where John's not the same John in Negative Approach that he's in Laughing Hyenas, but like it's cool to watch him kind of like always be John in these different projects.
Yeah.
Same way with you.
I try.
Well, anytime you want to try here on this podcast or anywhere, Tim, you are always welcome.
Very cool, man. No, this has been fun.